Sermons from the Journey is an audio podcast of the weekly message preached by Reverend Rebecca Clark, pastor at Trinity United Methodist Church in Montpelier, Vermont, and blogging online at pastorbecca.com. Thanks for listening.
Now, as you know, I don't typically use a manuscript. This will probably mark about the fifth time in 7 years that I've used one. And I tend to use manuscripts either when I'm about to say something controversial and want to make sure I say it really clearly and the way I intended, or when there's a topic about which I have a lot to say, and if I don't keep to a script, I'll stray off and we'll be here till next Tuesday. Or perhaps today, both. We shall see. I don't really like this passage. I like last week's passage about the gate opening the sheepfold out into the pasture wide into abundant life. And I like the passage that comes after that when Jesus says that not only is he the good shepherd caring for the sheep of this flock, but that there are many sheep from many other flocks and that he's going to gather them all together. I love those images of inclusiveness and God's all-encompassing grace. And then there's John 14:6. No one comes to the Father except through me. I don't like that verse. In fact, I had an entirely different sermon and worship service prepared for today, specifically so that I could avoid preaching on that text. But for some reason or other, inspiration struck very early Saturday morning, and I've learned that you have to listen. But this is a verse that some Christians like to fling at Jews and Muslims and Buddhists and Hindus and neo-pagans and atheists and anyone else we can find. It's a verse that proves that we're right and everybody else is wrong. The verse that confirms that every non-church person I've ever met says about church people, that we're exclusive, arrogant, self-righteous, judgmental. It is also a beautiful verse about affirming our faith in Christ, about finding in him hope for truth and life eternal. But it can also be an exclusive verse that seems to validate our salvation at the expense of everyone else, as if our salvation is only true or real or good if we can prove that other people are condemned. At least, that's how it reads, and that's how this passage reads, if we see the Bible in a particular way, if we see the Bible as a book about who gets to go to heaven and how. Now, I love this book. I really do. I've devoted my life to studying this book, to reading it over and over and over again in different contexts and different settings. And I've studied it a lot, and this book is many, many things. But let me tell you something it's not. At least not in its entirety. This book is not a checklist about how to get into heaven. That's not its primary function. It's not a crib notes version of how to get on God's good side. It's not a get out of hell free pass. It's not a copy of the afterlife for dummies. It's not a handbook for the afterlife at all. It's a handbook for this life. And it's about seeing and serving God here and now and always. And that's not enough of a description. It's actually the powerful, earth-shattering story of the eternal relationship between God and humanity, between God and all of creation. It's the revelation of what God is doing and has been doing and will be doing always, what God is about, and the invitation to be part of that, now and forever after. It's not a book about being taken home to Jesus. It's about taking Jesus with us, everywhere, always. It's not about going to heaven to be with God. It's about living a life infused with God's presence. But if we expect it to be a heaven-ready checklist, then that's what we'll see. If we expect it to tell us who's in and who's out, then that's what we will get. It's a phenomenon called confirmation bias, which means that we see what we expect to see, And we respond to and hold on to information that confirms what we already suspect. Right? We don't come to things with open minds, but with our own expectations. We respond to suggestion and internalize it, and then subconsciously project our expectations on what we experience. That's why fortune cookies and horoscopes are so popular and fun. We can read just about anything into the words on the paper, right? And then we see the prediction that they hold play out in our lives because that's what we're expecting to see. It's also why self-talk is effective. Like I was saying to the children, we tell ourselves we're going to have a great day, and lo and behold, we do. Or we complain that we got up on the wrong side of the bed and nothing seems to be going right, and so nothing does. We also fill in the blanks around us with what we expect. It's kind of like a gestalt image seen here. The shape is not complete in the picture, but our brain fills in the gaps with what we expect so that we get a complete triangle or a complete circle when one really isn't there. Now, we do this with the Bible. Uh-oh. We don't necessarily come to it with open minds and hearts, ready to hear what God might say to us, especially not about what happens after we die, because that's something that we feel really strongly about. And so we think we know what it says, and when we do read something about heaven or hell, we supply details from our own expectations. But most of those expectations don't actually come from the Bible. Heaven as a city in the clouds with the pearly gate, not in the Bible. Though New Jerusalem, which is heaven on earth, God's new creation come to earth, that has a gate made of pearl, a fiery pit, and a guy who has horns and carries a pitchfork, not in the Bible. But the Bible has many different hellish images, including a trash heap, a pit, a lake of fire. The guy with the horns and the pointy stick comes from various pagan mythologies. Angels that are the dearly departed, now sporting wings and halos. Not what angels are in the Bible. Biblical angels are warriors and messengers, the very fire of God. And cherubim, while we're at it, are not those little cute bare-bottomed babies with bows and arrows that make people fall in love. Those are pagan love gods. Cherubim in the Bible are these really bizarre, wacky creatures with like at least six wings covering their faces and their feet and flying, and they have eyes all over the place. There's nothing cute and cuddly about that. And our images about the afterlife come from lots of places outside the Bible. They come from John Milton's Paradise Lost. They come from Dante's Inferno. They come from TV and movies. They come from Far Side cartoons. We know exactly what that is, right? Those familiar images of what the afterlife is and whether you get a harp or an accordion. Those expectations seep into our understandings and affect the way we read the Bible, so that then when we hear something or read something about heaven, we picture that. We picture the clouds and the angels with the wings and harps. But most of those expectations and images are not actually in the Bible. And those expectations also keep us from seeing the Bible primarily as a cheat sheet about how to get into heaven, because that's what we expect it to be. About 100 years ago, one specific idea that's not in the Bible gained a lot of popularity as a particular interpretation of the Bible presented a timeline of the end times and predictions about how and when the world would end, and whether or not true believers would be subjected to all of the scary, painful mess of things that are supposed to accompany that. Now, people of all faiths have been predicting the end of the world for all of recorded history, and there's no indication that we're ever going to stop doing that. It's part of what we do with the anxiety and scariness of living and hoping that things get better. But this particular idea included the concept of the rapture of the saved, the rapture of the faithful. God scooping up those faithful ones in the blink of an eye to spare them from the horrors of the devastation about to be unleashed. And that is not in the Bible. It's picked out of different verses from different places and different parts of the Bible, but it's not, this doctrine is not in the Bible. But it doesn't stop people who've come to believe that the rapture is true and a biblical concept from reading that image then back into the Bible every time there's a verse or a passage that might lend itself to that interpretation, and then filling in the blanks with what they expect to see, seeing evidence of it in otherwise unrelated texts and trying to make predictions about when it will occur, all of those predictions, including the one that it would happen yesterday, having been wrong. We see what we want to see. If we want to see a get-out-of-hell-free pass, then that's what we see. If we expect to see a pre-rapture checklist, then that's what we see. If we want confirmation that we are in and everybody else is out, then that's all we will see. If we expect the Bible to tell us that there's only one way to salvation and that that salvation is an afterlife in heaven, then that's what we will see. But I believe that if we come to the text with open hearts and listen for what God is saying, we always find something more powerful than what we expect. We find something that exceeds our expectations. So let me tell you one last story. Once upon a time, there was a way of worshiping God that was tied to the temple in Jerusalem and the sacrifices made at the altar there. Only those who could afford to travel to Jerusalem and offer an acceptable dove or lamb or calf could have their sins forgiven. Only through the high priest and his intercession could one come by proxy to the presence of the holy. This worship was set in the cultural background then of Rome, where many capricious gods set things in motion and then were unpredictable in their response to human actions because they were too busy with their own colorful interpersonal lives, always fighting with each other and always making up with each other, if you know what I mean. Those Roman gods were cuckoo. Only through the emperor and his state-sponsored prophets, who would sacrifice chickens and then read their internal organs like tea leaves, could one know what the will of the divine ones was. And it's in that cultural context where corrupt soothsayers and greedy priests and power-hungry emperors and wealthy temple politicians claimed that they were the gatekeepers to God and that through them one could access the divine, Jesus dares to utter these words. Words that we might expect to be exclusive. Words that we might expect to be a comfort to us at the expense of others. Words that are instead a direct counterpoint to the claims of the prophets and the priests and the emperors and the power grabbers. I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. Not through the temple. Not through the high priest. Not through the soothsayers with their chicken innards. Not through the emperor. I am the way, Jesus says. They are not. It's not what we expect. And the way to what? The way to what? The way to heaven? Sure, that's what we see if we expect the Bible to be the afterlife for dummies, that Jesus is saying, I am the way to get into heaven. If that's what we expect the Bible is all about. But if we expect the Bible to be about more than that, and we expect Jesus to be telling us more than that, then we see that Jesus is not just talking about heaven or about being with God in the hereafter. He's talking about access to God, which is about so much more than a place people can go after death. It's about a way of life. It's not a claim about who's in and who's out. It's a claim about what God is doing. It's a claim about who Christ is. God is giving humanity direct access to the holy, a way to live in the divine presence without temples or sacrifices or rituals or emperors and priests and hierarchy. And the early Christians got it. They called themselves the followers of the way or the people of the way. They knew that they were following Christ as the way, the truth, the life, not because it would get them into heaven, but because it brought them at that moment into God's presence. If we expect the Bible to tell us how to get into heaven, or more importantly, that we will get into heaven and others will not, then this passage is both a comfort and a frighteningly exclusive warning. But just like the rapture-predicting hopefuls, we run the risk of reading our own expectations into the Bible, placing our ideas and images on Jesus' lips rather than listening to the Word and the Word made flesh. If we let go of our expectations, we open our hearts to hear what God is saying, we find instead that this passage, like the whole of the Bible, is not only promising us God's presence after we die, but inviting us to live in such a way, to live in the way, that we can be with God and part of God's unfolding kingdom in this age and in whatever age is to come. You may have noticed that none of us were raptured yesterday. But that does not mean that we have not been ushered into God's presence. We have been brought home to God through Christ the way. No tricks, no perfect lambs to sacrifice, because he put himself in place of all that. We have been invited to live in the presence and the way of God here and now and always. And that is something wonderful to anticipate. Amen.